Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host as we go through recent developments in the area of public safety, labor, and employment. I want to start by giving you a little bit of update for what's been going on here at LRIS in Portland. We are releasing, as I'm recording this podcast, the 8th edition of my book on the rights of law enforcement officers. This was definitely a labor of love. I probably put the word read in quotes because it really means skimmed in many cases. Probably read 3,000-4,000 cases over the course of putting together this book, cases that have been decided in the last 6 years. Law enforcement officers are, without any question, the single most litigious group of employees. And I think it's because of this tension that we have seen going on for years and years in law enforcement. And the tension is the desire of a law enforcement officer to have her or his private life remain just that, their private life, without any intervention on the part of the employer. And on the employer side, the desire to, in some instances, control what it is the officer does in their private lives. You see this tension play out with respect to free speech issues, particularly in the area of social media. You see it play out with respect to residency rules and grooming codes. And I think it's that tension that is at the heart of this really tremendous spate of litigation out there involving the rights of law enforcement officers. At any rate, the book weighs in at, and literally weighs in, it's a big book, at around 800 pages. And of course, there'll be an electronic edition of the book that will include with it the actual text of several hundred cases, the important cases involving law enforcement officer rights. On the seminar front, we have adjusted our 2021 seminar schedule, and we've adjusted it by making our first seminar in May of 2021. And we'll have one seminar a month, essentially, for the following 6 months. It'll be our usual lineup of seminars. We'll have a seminar on the rights of law enforcement officers concerning the book, one on how to run a police and fire union. That's our best attended seminar and involves information, very, I think, useful information about the day-to-day mechanics of effectively running a police or fire union. We'll be talking, we'll have a seminar that focuses on wellness, one that involves grievances and arbitration. And lastly, we'll probably end up with the year with an advanced police discipline seminar. So we'll be running a full slate of in-person seminars, all in Las Vegas, with the exception of one that we will be holding in Nashville. We hope you can come see us. That's sort of the heart of what it is we do in LRIS, has been the seminars. And I've got to say, I've been missing them. I've been missing the contact with everybody and just simply the experience of the seminar, the back and forth that we have with our seminar attendees. We have been in the process of converting several of our seminars to webinar format. We are going to have three of them that we hope to release in the next 3 months. What we will have is a series of 90-minute webinars. They'll be live, but you could also view them on your own schedule as opposed to participating in them live. It's given me a really good opportunity to go through our PowerPoint presentations, create some new ones, and with respect to the others, spend a lot of time adjusting them for webinar format, updating them, and in general, making them as interesting as they possibly can be. It's been a lot of work doing that. For each hour of a seminar, I'm spending somewhere between 10 and 20 hours updating the PowerPoint presentations, but I love the results. And things, the webinars, I think, are going to be very, very fast-paced and very informative. One of the webinars is going to be a topic we've never done anything on before because there hasn't really been a need. It's going to be on police reform legislation. And in that webinar, I will summarize the main thrusts. There are 15 main thrusts of police reform legislation around the country and what's happening with it. So that's where we are with LRIS. We're all healthy and looking forward to the future. Okay, let's get into the cases. Let's talk about the cases. First of all, there's a case out of the Wisconsin Employee Relations Commission, Employment Relations Commission, that I think draws an interesting distinction that is an important one for all of us to keep in mind. When does an employer have to disclose disciplinary files? Well, maybe we should start with a predicate question. Does an employer have to provide to a union the complete investigatory file on an employee? And the answer to that is, yeah, the employer has to. A disciplinary file is considered information that's relevant to either a grievance or a potential grievance. It's also relevant to the mandatorily negotiable subject of discipline, and it's part and parcel of the obligation to collectively bargain in good faith to share information relevant to grievances and relevant to mandatory subjects of bargaining. And this obligation to disclose this information exists even in the absence of a firefighter or peace officer Bill of Rights. And those types of statutes, they exist in 17 different states, can even have more heightened disclosure requirements. But it's not the question. The case I want to talk about doesn't deal with the question of whether disclosure has to happen. It instead deals with the issue of when disclosure has to happen. So what's going on in this case? This is a case that involves a union that is named the Milwaukee Police Supervisors Organization. I'll call it the organization. And it represents supervisors in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Police Department. In May of 2019, May 1st, May 8th, a police sergeant received written notice from the department that he'd be interviewed 2 weeks later as part of an IA investigation into the sergeant's negligent driving. The notice that the employee received said explicitly, disciplinary action may result. Now, this isn't the first time the sergeant's driving had been investigated. A criminal investigation into the same conduct had been conducted and closed in November 2018 with no criminal charges filed. So here we are 6 months later, and the department is cranking up an internal affairs investigation. But you've got now a complete investigatory file that was done in the criminal case. So once the organization receives this notice that the sergeant is going to be interviewed, the first thing it does on the same day, on May 1, it asks the city for a copy of the criminal investigation file. And the city says, no, we don't have to give it to you because our IA investigation hasn't been completed. And the city doesn't provide the file. The sergeant is interviewed on May 14th. The sergeant was accompanied by a shop steward or an organization representative. And later that same day, the internal affairs investigator turns out a 7-page summary of the investigation, including the interview with the sergeant. And within a month, the department has issued charges against the sergeant. And the charges include an allegation that the sergeant had violated the department's code of conduct through the driving behavior. The sergeant submits an apology as his response to the charges. And very frustratingly, the opinion of the Labor Commission in Wisconsin doesn't tell us whether the sergeant got disciplined or whether the sergeant was able to avert discipline with the apology. What we know happened was the organization filed an unfair labor practice charge. In Wisconsin, those are called prohibited practice charges, with the Employment Relations Commission saying the city violated its obligation to share bargaining information with the organization by its refusal to provide the investigatory file prior to the sergeant's interview. What does the commission do with this charge? Get out the big rubber stamp with red ink that says dismissed. The commission says, look, we know that we have prior case law that prior to a due process hearing, a Loudermill hearing, or if you're in California, a Skelly hearing, prior to a due process hearing, you've got to turn over, the employer has to turn over all investigatory materials, including criminal investigatory files. We know we have ruled that way in the past, and we know the basis for our ruling in the past is that the union's interest in having the employee avoid unfair discipline and the union's interest in the overall fairness and equity of the employer's investigatory and disciplinary procedures, those interests outweigh the employer's interest in the confidentiality of the file. We know we have ruled that way, that you've got to turn it over, turn these materials over prior to a due process interview. But, says the commission, the calculus is different when the request for a file precedes the employee's interview. It's not that it's not relevant anymore. It is relevant. It's just that the balance is drawn differently. Here's a quote from the commission. The investigation was not complete. A preliminary determination to impose discipline had not been made, and the organization's role in the meeting was limited to assisting the employee as he responded to questioning. Balancing the strength of the organization's interests against those of the city, we conclude that the city's interests predominate, and thus the city didn't violate its duty to bargain by refusing to provide the criminal investigatory file. That's a balance that I have seen drawn by many other labor boards. They will say, you got to turn it over prior to the due process hearing, but you don't have to turn it over prior to the interview of the employee. Now, the rationale for striking that balance differs a little bit. In some places, you'll see labor boards say the employer is entitled to hear the employee's version of the events before the employee looks at the file. But that is usually where the dividing line is drawn. No obligation to turn it over prior to the employee interview. Obligation to turn it over prior to the due process hearing after the investigation has concluded. There's another procedural disciplinary case that came out in the last month that is an interesting one. And also, this case, like the last one, I don't think really breaks any new ground. But what I think it does is to cement some basic principles that I think we're all well worth reminded of from time to time. So this comes out of Delaware, and it involves a police officer named Eric Hiller, who's a police officer with the Rehoboth Beach Police Department. There's a Peace Officer's Bill of Rights in Delaware. Now, in July of 2018, the department tells Hiller, you've got to participate in a computer voice stress analyzer exam. What is that? That's kind of a form of a polygraph examination. I'm actually surprised to see a law enforcement agency using voice stress analysis. You don't see that very often. And most bills of rights also prohibit polygraph or related or similar examinations for law enforcement officers. Obviously, Delaware's does not. But anyway, this thing just kind of surprised me to see that the department is telling Hiller, hey, you've got to participate in this voice stress analysis exam. And why is the department doing this? It turns out Hiller had been involved in an incident that where there was a problem with a prisoner transport. There was an excessive force allegation related to the prisoner transport. And there were questions about the truthfulness of his statements made during his interview in that prior investigation. So comes the day of the interview, and there are four people who are in the room when the analysis or the interview is about to start. One of them is a lieutenant from the department, Lieutenant Jamie Riddle. A second is a contractor, a private voice stress analysis examiner, a guy named Mike McQuillan. And the third is Hiller. Who's the fourth? Is it the union rep, you might ask? No, it's Hiller's wife. You can tell this isn't going to go well. So Lieutenant Riddle asks Hiller before the exam actually starts. He asks Hiller and his wife, are you recording the examination? Because in Delaware, that apparently is prohibited. And then this exchange ensues. And I'm going to read you the back and forth on this because I think it really gives you a feel for what happened. So Lieutenant Riddle starts off by saying, are you refusing because I'm asking you questions? Hiller says, you asked me and I answered it. What they're talking about there is Riddle had said, is anybody recording? And Hiller initially refuses to answer. Okay, back to the Q&A. Riddle, is anyone other than me recording this interview? I'm asking you that question. Hiller, just as you stated right there, I am permitted to ask questions as it relates to my job, correct? Lieutenant Riddle, is anyone in this room besides me recording this interview? Hiller, not me, and I don't know whether that is the only recording he has. I have no idea. Lieutenant Riddle, to your knowledge, is anyone else in this room besides me and Mr. McQuillan? Hiller interrupts, I'm prepared to go forward. And this goes back and forth for a few more Q&As. I've got to tell you, I'm recording this the night after the first presidential debate. And when I'm reading what Lieutenant Riddle is asking here, where he's asking the same question three times, four times, without getting an answer from Hiller, I'm thinking about the moderator in the debate last night and thinking, wow, these guys are somewhat in the same place. So after this colloquy, Hiller announced that he's done. He doesn't want to participate in the exam. He wants to go talk to counsel, and the interview ends. And later on, apparently Hiller does come back and does do an exam after he talks with a lawyer, but the damage had been done. A three-member disciplinary hearing panel found that while Hiller wasn't dishonest, he was, and the phrase that was used, circuitous and semantical during the exchange. Now, the panel also went on to find that the department violated Hiller's rights under Delaware's Bill of Rights. And the violations, there were several of them. Insufficient notice of the exam, allowing an outside contractor to question Hiller, and questioning Hiller for an unreasonable amount of time. So the hearing panel found that Hiller potentially was subject to discipline, but that the department in three different ways had violated Hiller's rights. The city fired Hiller, and he sued, and he brought a lawsuit that is based on a legal theory that is called mandamus. And if you haven't heard mandamus before, What it is it's a form of action in court. It's what's called an equity cause of action, where you're trying to get the court to compel somebody to do something. And with mandamus, typically what you're trying to do is to get the court to order a public entity to do something that it is legally obligated to do. All right? So that's the type of lawsuit that Hiller brings. And what he wants is the court to order the department to reverse his termination. And here's the court's answer. The court says, not every Bill of Rights violation supports mandamus, supports, in other words, a court order requiring an employer to do something. The court says Hiller got a hearing in front of the panel. That panel absolved him of dishonesty and other charges. And the panel even found Bill of Rights violations. But he wasn't terminated for any of that stuff. He was terminated because of the colloquy that went on prior to the first voice stress analysis interview. And here's what the court ends up saying, and I'm going to quote. Hiller knew he was being investigated concerning the transport of the prisoner and would have to submit to an exam. Further, he brought his wife as his representative. Hiller was circuitous and semantical when asked whether he and his wife were recording the interview. Hiller knew of the prohibition on recording an interview. In certain circumstances, the court says, mandamus may address Bill of Rights violations, including reinstatement. However, the violations must be substantial in nature. Bill of Rights violations that do not rise to the level of procedural or substantive due process violations don't warrant mandamus. Here, the violations put forth by Hiller are mere technical ones. Well, that's the broad principle that I do think is worthy of reinforcement for all of us. And you tend to see this with the way courts interpret peace officer bills of rights and even the way they decide some constitutional due process cases. You're going to see courts saying not every technical violation of a Bill of Rights or due process is going to warrant reversal of discipline and reinstatement of the employee. We need to see something substantial. For example, referring here to a long series of cases out of California, if an employer doesn't complete a disciplinary investigation within the time specified by the statute of limitations, that's a substantial violation. That's not a mere technical violation. But a mere technical violation like this one, one that did not impact the outcome of the disciplinary investigation, that's not going to warrant reversal of the termination. I now want to turn to a firefighter case that comes out of the District of Columbia. This is another one that is not so much an announcement of new principles, but it's really important to talk about the basic tenets that are involved in this case because they're not always well understood. And the question that is raised in this case and in many others like it is, the question of when can an employee sue an employer for an illness or injury caused on the job? This takes us right into the world of workers' compensation and the grand compromise that workers' compensation systems are. Workers' compensation systems came into being in this country, started really in earnest just after the turn of the 20th century. And what's the grand compromise? Workers' compensation systems set up a system where fault is irrelevant to whether or not the employee is entitled to medical treatment and compensation for on-the-job injuries. An employee can be completely negligent and be injured as a result and still receive compensation under a workers' compensation system. That's half of the grand compromise. The employee's fault is irrelevant. What's on the other side of the compromise? Where's the balance? Workers' compensation systems are the exclusive remedy for illnesses or injuries caused by the job. Lawsuits are not allowed for those sorts of harms that are done to employees. So employees give up with a workers' compensation system the ability to bring a lawsuit for an illness or an injury, but they get in exchange for that a system where their fault is irrelevant. Employers get one other, I think, very significant advantage with a workers' compensation system, and that is that the amount of recovery that an employee can get through workers' compensation is markedly lower than what an employee could get for the same illness or injury were the employer's liability established in court. You don't see, for example, in workers' compensation, awards for pain and suffering, no matter how much pain and suffering there may be. That's just not a feature of a workers' compensation system. Many workers' compensation injuries are what are called scheduled injuries, where there's actually a table you can look up in your state, and you can see if you lose your left hand at the wrist, you can see a dollar amount that you're going to recover. And those dollar amounts are typically, 10% of what you could recover if you were bringing the same sort of claim in court. So that's the grand compromise of workers' compensation systems. And it is subject to one exception. And that exception is that if an employer acts with such a degree of misconduct that the employee can be said to have had their Fifth Amendment rights to life, liberty, and property deprived of them, that the bar on bringing a private lawsuit will not prevent the bringing of that constitutional lawsuit. So there's sort of a Fifth Amendment due process constitutional law exception to the notion that under a workers' compensation system, all claims have to be brought through the workers' compensation process for illness or injury related to the job. And as you might imagine, this District of Columbia case involves that exception. So what goes on in this case? This involves a newly hired DC firefighter by the name of Dane Smothers. And on August 2 of 2017, he is struck by a ladder truck operated by DC Fire when Smothers was attending his first fire. He sustained serious injuries in the accident, and he filed a lawsuit, and he sued the operators of the truck as well as the District of Columbia government. By the way, you can't get around typically a workers' compensation bar by suing individual employees as opposed to suing the employer itself. But what he's saying here, what Smothers is saying here, is these individuals are liable because I fall within the due process exception to the workers' compensation bar. So what is the claim that Smothers is making? He's saying that the drivers of the ladder truck intentionally drove into him to avoid a collision with another truck. And he argues that an intentional injury that is caused by a governmental actor falls within this due process exception to the workers' compensation bar. And this all ends up with a federal trial court judge in the District of Columbia, and he dismisses the case or dismisses the claim. What is behind the court's dismissal of the claim? And I'm going to read you a few sentences from the court's opinion. The court says, look, the U.S. Supreme Court has explained in some detail why decisions made by public officers on the street in the heat of the moment are not likely to supply the basis for a constitutional claim. The Supreme Court has given significant weight to the fact that employees who have practically instantaneous responses aren't going to be liable for breach of due process. That applies here, out of the court's opinion now. The court says, look, the two who were operating the truck, Kerry and Dyson, they were operating a vehicle under exigent circumstances. They were responding to a fire. They were forced to make split-second decisions, in this case, between two dangerous alternatives. The court says, I've taken a look at the complaint that Smothers filed here. I don't see any allegation that Kerry and Dyson were motivated by any sort of malicious intent to harm Smothers or any other improper motive. And for that reason, the conduct does not shock the conscience of the court, and there is no due process claim. And that's the standard. Is the conduct of the employer of such a level that it, and I'm quoting, shocks the conscience of the court? What you typically need to meet that standard is going to be conduct that was intentional in nature, where one employee intended to harm another. And it's not going to apply in these sorts of negligence, or really a negligence type case. The last case I want to talk about, while it is an employment case, actually it involves some much broader principles. I will frequently hear the argument out there in the public safety world that employers are subject to a great deal of liability or potential liability for failure to train. And I want to say those statements are frequently overblown. It's very, very difficult to establish a failure to train case. And a recent lawsuit that comes out of Pennsylvania does a wonderful job of explaining why it is so difficult to bring one of these claims. So what's this case about? It's about a police sergeant in the Lower Merion, Pennsylvania Police Department. She brought a lawsuit, and the lawsuit was essentially a hostile work environment lawsuit, saying that there have been all sorts of rumors about me in the police department that have been sexually charged. Those rumors involve claims that I've been sleeping with supervisors and members of neighboring police departments. There's even a rumor that I was promoted because I was willing to have sex with my supervisor. I have complained about these rumors, and I was told that's just simply the way this place works. She did acknowledge that the department had launched one investigation into the whole issue, but the investigation was into her, she said, as to whether or not she was having an inappropriate relationship with another officer. And she said the result of that was I got transferred to a less senior and a less prestigious platoon. So this is kind of a general hostile work environment claim. And one of the particulars of the claim is this failure to train argument. And the court has to address what the legal standards are under which a governmental body can be held liable for a failure to train. And here's the court's analysis of it. And it's, I think this is wonderfully stated. I'm going to read to you maybe four sentences here, a little bit more than I normally read, because the court does such a good job of laying out the standard. The court says, quote, in order to establish a failure to train claim, the employee must show that the locality's failure to train its employees meets the stringent standard of deliberate indifference to the employee's rights. Deliberate indifference to the employee's rights. Okay, what's that going to be? Quote, in order to establish deliberate indifference, the employee must show that the municipality had actual or constructive notice of a particular omission in its training that resulted in its employees inflicting harm on other employees. Let me pause a moment. Wow. The employer had to have notice that there was something wrong with its training. There was an omission in its training, and that omission caused employees to harm each other. Okay, back to the court. Quote, if the city had notice, then the city has effectively deliberately chosen a training program that will cause violations of constitutional rights. Generally, to establish notice, the employee must show a pattern of similar constitutional violations by untrained employees. That is an almost impossible standard to meet, right? You're going to have to show that the employer is acting so recklessly or intentionally with respect to its training program, not just that it's choosing the wrong training, but that it knows that the omissions, the problems with its training, have caused employees to harm each other. That's a really tough threshold. So what about Pepitone? Does she meet that threshold? No, says the court. Why not? She fails on the notice prong. Pepitone tried to prove notice by pointing to two lawsuits that have been filed against the department for hostile work environment, sexual harassment. Problem, one of the lawsuits was 20 years before her lawsuit, and the other was 17 years before her lawsuit. That's just simply too far distant in time, says the court. Pepitone has not been able to establish that there is a pattern of sexual misconduct, says the court. Simply pointing to what happened to her doesn't establish a pattern. And two cases, 17 and 20 years ago, don't help at all. And the court ends up dismissing Pepitone's lawsuit. So next time you hear the phrase, failure to train, remember, that's a very, very difficult claim to bring. That's it for the October 2020 edition of First Thursday. Hope you'll join us next month. I anticipate we're going to have a ton of cases to talk about next month because we're starting to see a huge uptick in the number of opinions that courts are writing. In the meantime, all of you, please stay safe. And this is Will Aitchison signing off.